twitched, trying to anticipate the amount of gas and the timing Nicole would need to slow the pitch down. Jasira pulled her hair back from the nape of her neck.
Hey, boss, how much is this really like space?
Parker shrugged.
Not much.
So why do we have to do it?
He shook his head and focused on the stopwatch and the window.
Come on, Oregon. You got this.
Moments later, the pitch evened out, and Nicole started working on the roll. It was tricky because you still had to manage the pitch, but she'd been getting faster each time. The jets popped with fast little bursts of gas as Nicole stabilized the yaw. Parker nodded.
Good. See how she's doing a double tap?
I cocked my head, listening to the jets fire as much as watching them. Is that better than a slow sustain?
When you're trying to gauge how much force it will take, yes.
He shifted his weight off his left leg and rolled his ankle a little.
The trouble with the slow sustain is that it might not be enough to make a difference, and you can bleed off a lot of fuel without realizing it.
Outside, the jets popped twice more, then gave a sustained hiss as Nicole got rid of the yaw rotation. I watched Parker set his foot down and the way he shifted his weight as if he were testing it. Clearing my throat, I took a step closer to him. Should we schedule some more T-38 time? He almost looked away from the window, but arrested the movement and stared at Nicole, spinning around and around.
Not necessary.
Since that trip to the clinic, he had only asked for one other side trip. We'd done other training, and I kept waiting for him to rat me out, but so far, he'd just been his usual condescending self, except when he taught. I almost liked him then.
Why do we have to do it?
Betty laid a hand on Parker's arm, a disturbingly intimate gesture.
If the gimbal isn't like space.
It's not, sweetheart. But it's more like it than most things you'll find on Earth.
He clicked the timer off.
Good. York, suit up. Morgan's been in there enough times today.
My heart ratcheted up to a higher gear. I tried to tell myself that it was excitement. Well, I mean it was. I liked the gimbal rig. I just didn't like having to run the gauntlet of reporters to get there. Parker walked to the door and rested his hand on the technician's shoulder.
Good job with her. Get the logs for me.
Yes, sir.
The tech straightened up as if just having Parker touch him had somehow revitalized him.
Excuse me?
Meddy put her hands on her hips.
This is our third time here and I haven't had a turn yet.
Parker barely cast a glance over his shoulder.
I'm not being paid to waste time or the government's resources. You just keep being pretty and writing your little articles.
Just when you thought he wasn't so bad. I mean, I didn't disagree with him, but I wouldn't actually say that out loud. Wait. No. I had said things that bad about Betty before. That's why she had to testify to Congress. I sighed and turned to her. Her cheeks had gone red, and she had pulled out her reporter's notebook. You okay?
Of course.
She smiled brightly and jotted a note.
Just need to describe what one of these tests looks like. It's easier to do that as an observer, right?
Sure.
Better get going or Parker will have your ass.
I headed to the door, grabbing my helmet from the bench. One of the technicians was helping Nicole out of the gimbal cage while Parker stood and talked with her. By his hand gestures, he was giving her some tips about the pitch corrections she'd made. I think his patience as a teacher was part of what blindsided me every time we clashed. I very deliberately stopped in front of the reporters to put my helmet on. Much like the other astronaut skills I was practicing, I had been trying to desensitize myself to the reporters. Today, I focused on posing without seeming to pose. Who knew that astronauts had to do so much modeling?
Elma! What's been the most exciting task today?
It was always tempting to say something like, getting my nails done, except I knew that they'd print it. Today, I simmed terminal docking maneuvers and tried to fine-tune RHC inputs through an overly generous deadband. See, learning acronyms was useful for something. The cameras snapped and whirred as I strapped the helmet on. This was fine. They weren't a threat, and I knew what they wanted. Maybe that was the key to my anxiety in general, figuring out what people wanted from me. Although if I kept that in mind, I would have gotten my flight suit tailored to show off my shape a little more, like I'm pretty sure Nicole had done. As she walked toward me from the gimbal rig, her waist nipped in just a little more than seemed possible in these boxy overalls. Parker followed her, smiling at the reporters. His limp didn't seem so bad today. Just a slight favoring of the left leg, and only if you were looking for it.
Colonel Parker, how are the ladies doing?
They're a credit to their nations.
He gave that shit-eating grin of his.
We're all very proud of them.
I headed for the gimbal rig, eager to see if I could drop my time from my last run.
Any truth to the rumor that you're being replaced on the moon landing?
The room went silent. Even the hum of the generators seemed to pause in mid-oscillation. Parker went pale, but his smile never faded.
I'd be curious to know your sources, but yes.
I hadn't told anyone anything. God, what had Nathaniel done? The room snapped back into motion. All of the reporters were shouting questions at Parker now. He held his hands up, and miraculously, they responded by shushing.
I have a lingering war injury that needs some attention, so the agency and I decided that it would be better to attend to that.
He gave another smile.
I'm sure you understand that I can't make any speculation about who is going to replace me. Now, if you'll excuse me, we have some testing to do. York, get in the chair.
Parker walked away from all of us. Instead of heading back into the observation booth, he left the room entirely. I hadn't told. God damn it, I hadn't told anyone. But there wasn't a chance in hell that Parker would believe me. Smiling at the tech who stood by to strap me into the rig, I gave a little shrug. I need to run to the ladies' room. Back in a flash. I hurried across the lab and out the door that Parker had used. As the door swung open, I caught him straightening from the wall as if he'd been leaning against it, and only the sound of the door had brought him upright. He looked over his shoulder with an easy smile. It fell from his face when he saw me.
I told you to get in the chair.
I didn't tell anyone. Besides Nathaniel, of course. But he'd said he would tell me before he took any action. Parker's face stayed blank, but he looked at the floor.
I did.
I was still about 10 feet away from him, but that stopped me in my tracks, but...
I have bone spurs in my neck, likely from ejections during my test pilot days. They're pressing on my spinal column.
He shrugged as if that was somehow no big deal.
I know what you think of me. But believe it or not, I care more about the program than I do about my place in it. I would have been a danger.
What do you say to that? Are you going to be okay?
Surgery. Tomorrow, actually.
Is there anything I can do?
Yeah. Get in the fucking chair like I told you to.
He raised his head and took a step closer.
And don't insult either of us by pretending you care.
Wow. You really do practice being offensive. The side of Parker's mouth curled.
Go. When I come back, you damn well better have mastered that thing.
Yes, sir. For a moment there, he'd seemed human. I forgot who I was dealing with.
Just so we're clear, you still need to keep your head down and do as you're told. So long as you aren't a threat to the program, my lips remain sealed.
He took another step.
You earned that much. But the moment I think you're in danger, you're out. Are we clear?
Swallowing, I nodded. Ironically, I wished that I hadn't left the mill town at home. The rumor mill said that if Parker hadn't done the bone spur surgery, he'd risk paralyzation, which made the whole I care more about the program thing complete bunk. Of course, the rumor mill also said that aliens had implanted probes in him. The Monday morning staff meeting started with Clemens and his usual cloud of cigar smoke.
So, the first thing is to let you all know that Colonel Parker's come through his surgery just fine. No complications, and we should see him back here in a month or so.
I have to admit that my first thought was of intense relief that Parker would be gone for a month. That got me farther away from my last doctor's appointment, and maybe even if he told someone about the mill town, it wouldn't look like it was a problem. No one had to know that I still had pills which I was hoarding for an emergency.
What, he had already the surgery?
Le Bourgeois raised his brows in surprise.
I have only just heard that he was ill.
Clemens nodded, puffing on his cigar.
He'd set up the appointment some time ago, but didn't want anyone to know because he thought it would distract you. Good man.
I may have rolled my eyes at that version of history.
Who's going up instead?
Betty, ever the journalist, leaned forward across the table.
To the moon, I mean.
His shadow was Maloof, so he'll step forward.
Clemens pulled his agenda toward him.
That's jumping ahead on today's schedule a bit, but we'll need to pull Maloof from the next Luneta flight so we can concentrate on training for the lunar mission. Binkowski and Terrazas are already up on the station. All of this has made us realize that we need more manpower.
Manpower, of course. Why use any of the women who are qualified and sitting right here when you could bring some more men in?
Now, I want to be clear that this isn't a PR decision. It has nothing to do with the UN hearings. We'd always planned on expanding the program as things got settled, and Colonel Parker's injury just accelerated that timetable a little.
Sure it did. I glanced at Nicole, who had her mouth twisted in a little moo of displeasure.
It'll take a while to get them hired and up to speed, so I'll need your patience and help with that. Meanwhile, I think it's time to deploy one of the ladies.
Sabia scooted her chair forward and stared at Clemens intently. You could see the same thought bubble over her head as was no doubt appearing over all of ours. Me, let it be me, please let it be me. I sat calmly with my hands folded on my lap, the way my mother had taught me. Beneath my shirt, my heart was leaping out and waving its metaphorical hands. Pick me, pick me!
Parker's suggestion, and I concur, is that we send up Jasira Paz-Viveros.
He lowered his cigar.
Congratulations.
Finally. A woman was finally going into space. Normally, duty assignments were quiet professional affairs, but even the men were visibly thrilled for Jasira. I congratulated her, grinning so hard my face hurt. And I meant it, too. But I was feeling such a weird mix of emotions.
Jasira deserved the flight. I was thrilled for her that she was going to be the first woman in space.
I was relieved that it wasn't Betty or Violette, who clearly would have just been picked for publicity. Jasira was a real pilot. I was also weirdly relieved that it wasn't me, because as the first woman in space, she would be subjected to a level of scrutiny that would break me, especially without resorting to Milltown. But beneath all of those thoughts, I was afraid, because there was a part of my brain that wondered if Parker really had managed to ground me.
37.
Women Are Ready for Space by Robert Reinhold. Kansas City, Kansas, December 16th, 1957. Next week, if all goes as planned, a new milestone in space history will be reached when Jasira Paz-Viveros is lofted into space for nearly 6 days to become the first woman there. The decision by the International Aerospace Coalition to send the 32-year-old beauty queen into space, along with two male crewmen, has been made despite long doubts, and what some might call prejudices, about the abilities of women to withstand the physical and psychological rigors of such an ordeal.
Sitting at the Capcom desk, I began to understand why Parker always had that damn tennis ball to throw. Mind you, I wasn't actually the Capcom yet. Cleary had that pleasure. I was just shadowing him while Binkowski and Maloof wrapped up their spacewalk. Cleary occupied himself by doodling and had filled a page with circles attached to circles attached to circles, and then a sudden jagged line.
Shit.
He sat up in his chair and turned the microphone on while simultaneously patching the capsule through to the loudspeakers.
What sort of problem?
Binkowski's voice crackled through the room, and the quiet murmur of idle conversation stopped.
We can't get the hatch closed.
Everyone started to move at once. Nathaniel grabbed his headset and the phone at the same time. I spun in my chair and reached for the library that spanned the shelves immediately behind the Capcom. The IAC had an entire volume dedicated to hatches and their closures.
Copy that. Describe the malfunction.
Cleary's voice gave no indication of the quiet energy that filled mission control. His job was to be the sole voice that the astronauts had to deal with while everyone else ran through all the possibilities.
It gets within 1 centimeter of closure and then stops. We've looked for obstructions, but nothing is obvious.
His breath echoed through mission control. I winced. The capsules didn't have airlocks, just a hatch on the side. For the spacewalks, both astronauts were in pressure suits. If they couldn't get the door closed, they couldn't repressurize, and they also couldn't re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Is it aligned correctly?
Yes. It is not an alignment issue.
Behind his voice was the steady hiss of oxygen flowing into his helmet. Nathaniel walked over carrying a schematic.
Tell him to open the hatch all the way. There's a stop that keeps it from swinging all the way open, but if he pulls it, then they can open it fully and get a better view.
Cleary nodded and repeated all of that to Binkowski.
Confirmed door release. Working on it now.
Through the speakers, we could hear his conversation with Maloof as they worked on the problem. Or rather, we could hear Maloof working on it. The capsule was so small that when suited, only one of them could be near the hatch at a time. While they worked, Nathaniel conferred with the mechanical team. At some point, Clemens came stalking into the room, still shrugging into his coat. He demanded a status report. I just tried to stay out of the way.
Kansas, we see the problem.
Maloof's voice broke through the chatter.
A loose washer is jammed in the seal near the hinge. We are attempting to pry it out.
Glad to hear it.
Cleary's shoulders relaxed a little. Mine, too. The worst part was not knowing what the problem was. Now all we could do was wait while they dealt with it. Nathaniel leaned over the Capcom desk and asked Cleary, a little too casually,
Any word on how Colonel Parker is doing?
Very well, although he has to wear the most amusing collar around his neck.
He grinned.
He does not find it amusing, of course. I think he called it the fun collar.
The fun collar? I looked at him. Really? I don't know if he blushed, but he suddenly became very interested in his circles again. Nathaniel exchanged a glance with me and mouthed, Fun collar. With an accompanying masturbatory hand gesture. Clearing my throat was probably not the most subtle way of masking a laugh. Any idea when he'll be able to, launch again? I'm sure that's high on his mind.
Yes.
Nathaniel nodded, suppressing a smirk.
Launches are very important.
Thank God Cleary missed all of that.
I believe it will be another year for the bones to fuse together, though he will be back at work much sooner.
Too bad. A year free of Parker would have been a joy.
Kansas, we cannot get the washer out. The gloves are too bulky to grab it. Maloof wants to try to use a screwdriver to pry it out. Will this compromise the seal? Please advise.
My husband faded away and Dr. Nathaniel York snapped into focus.
How much oxygen do they have left?
Cleary frowned at him.
They are asking about the...
He shook his head.
What are your oxygen levels in the suits?
45 minutes, plus or minus 5.
Binkowski's voice had that disconcerting pilot calm, as if he weren't discussing possible death. Nathaniel rubbed his mouth.
Here's the call we have to make. If they rip the seal, they can't pressurize.
If they can't shut the door, they also can't pressurize.
Nathaniel turned to the computers.
Basira, what's the current state vector of the Luneta platform?
She grabbed a sheet of paper and rattled off all 7 parts of the vector, 3 for position, 3 for velocity, and 1 for time. It was in a higher orbit than the spacecraft, which, thanks to orbital mechanics, meant it was going slower. They might be able to catch it. Clemens nodded, seeing where Nathaniel was going with that question.
Can they get to the space station before their air runs out?
In theory, maybe.
He called across the room again to the computers.
Basira, I need a trajectory and burn rates for a station rendezvous. Get the station's MC on the line. They may need to transfer to a lower orbit to meet them.
My legs itched with the urge to go to Basira and Myrtle's table, look at the numbers, and just do the math. But there were competent people there, and my job was here. To shadow. To sit and learn, and do nothing unless asked. Clemens said,
Here's my thinking. Can we have Binkowski pilot toward the station while Maloof continues to work on the hatch? If he gets it, well and good. If not, they're closer to the station.
Nathaniel shook his head.
If they fire the rockets with the hatch open, there's a high probability the kick will torque the hinge out of true. I think they'll either have to lash it open while Maloof works or just go for digging it out.
He glanced at Cleary.
Check me on any practical considerations since you've spent time in the capsule.
Cleary squinted, moving his hands as if he were trying things out.
Lashing it in those gloves. That's going to take some time.
time. It would take them 10 minutes to dock at best, which only gave them half an hour to do the rendezvous. They have to do the burn now. Everyone stared at me as if a potted plant had spoken, except Nathaniel. His vivid blue eyes locked on mine like a tracking laser. Without turning from me, he raised his voice.
Basira, I need the state vectors on both craft, now.
She didn't blink, just grabbed the right page on the first go. Across from her, Myrtle circled numbers from the teletype and handed them to her. She was a good mathematician and methodical, but I was faster. I'm not sure where the pencil came from, but as Basira called out numbers, I jotted them down for reference across the page of Cleary's circles. While we worked, Nathaniel turned to Cleary.
Tell the crew to dig the washer out.
What about the seal?
Even if the capsule is leaking, that's going to give them a better shot at docking than having it wide open. At this point, we're assuming no re-entry.
Clemens nodded.
Tell them that we're sending up a burn attitude and targets, and they should maneuver as soon as they get them and load the targets.
There are times when numbers paint pictures in my head. They intersected with my pilot's brain, and I could see the arc of the ship and the controls in my hand. I double-checked my numbers anyway. Maloof and Binkowski had one chance.
Chances we have the washer out. The seal did tear. 2 centimeters. Should we attempt to repressurize?
Back at his desk, Nathaniel said,
Negative. We may need to redirect oxygen to their suits.
The atmosphere in the firing room crackled with such intense focus. Somewhere in the support room, an engineering team was jumping into motion to figure out how to do that. And yet we all sounded as if we were discussing weather. Cleary might have been offering them lemonade.
Confirmed seal breach. Do not, repeat, do not attempt repressurization. We'll have the burn attitude and targets for you shortly.
Confirmed, Kansas. We'll stay in our suits.
Still writing, I glanced at the clock and my insides clenched. 12:32. This was so close. Expect a 43-second burn starting at 12:35. Someone cursed as they saw the margins snap into place. Final approach to Lynetta Station commences... 10 minutes, 10 minutes, after the burn. I lifted my pencil. Also, contact station and have them maneuver to docking attitude, perform attitude hold, and feather the arrays. If they didn't do that, the solar arrays would be in the way. Nathaniel took a step closer to me. He inhaled as if he were about to ask if I was sure, and then nodded. He looked at the clock. 12:33.
Do it.
Cleary looked to Clemens, who hesitated for a fraction of a second, and then nodded.
GC, give us a 10-minute countdown on the clock.
The ground controller set one of the mission clocks to count down from 10. While he did that, as matter-of-fact as a janitor, Cleary relayed my numbers to the capsule. From the calm of Cleary's voice, you'd think we'd just pulled this out of the library. We had hundreds of volumes of calculations for things that might go wrong en route to the moon. But needing to make a rendezvous in 40 minutes with a leaking hatch? Nothing we had took that into account. Binkowski responded with a calm to match Cleary's.
Copy, Kansas. Commencing burn.
The next half hour dragged and raced at the same time. It felt like forever. Listening to them and being able to do nothing except adjust numbers as they got closer. And then time would jump ahead, eating up the amount of oxygen they had left. At some point, I moved over to the computers table and joined Myrtle and Basira in tracking the 2 spacecraft. Engineering managed to buy them 15 more minutes by having Binkowski bleed oxygen from one of the fuel cells, but it reduced the amount of power that they had available. If they took any more, none of the electrical systems in the capsule would work. The station came online.
We can see the shape of their vehicle now.
They were still miles away from the station. If they got the approach wrong, they could whiz past and lose time trying to correct.
0.7 miles out, closing at 31 feet per second.
This was all up to Binkowski now. He wasn't talking because the flight surgeon had instructed them to remain silent to conserve oxygen.
2,724 feet. 19.7 feet per second.
So close. Please let them be okay.
1,370. 9.8 feet per second.
Kansas, Lunetta, we're breaking.
Minkowski's voice had a wheeze to it. I traded a look with Cleary.
50 feet and holding steady.
In the control room, no one was breathing, as if we were all trying to conserve air for Minkowski and Maloof.
Kansas, we have them.
Around me, the room erupted in cheers and prayers while I slumped forward to rest my face on the desk. That had been terrifyingly close. And if it had happened at the moon, with no space station to retreat to, we would be listening to them dying right now. The moment we were through the apartment door, Nathaniel dropped his briefcase and kicked the door shut with his foot. His arms slid around my waist and pulled me back against him where his attention was quite apparent. His breath warmed my neck as he kissed it.
You are a miracle.
I'm a computer.
And a pilot.
He kissed a spot higher on my neck.
And an astronaut.
In training. Nathaniel nipped my neck. Hey! I laughed and turned in his arms to face him. The apartment was dark save for the street lamps shining through the window in a sodium glaze. Someone else would have realized the burn issue.
But not fast enough.
One hand came up to draw a line across my forehead. His fingers were cool and rough against my skin.
We've been damn lucky. And you, today, were part of that luck. By your convergence of experience and your extraordinary, captivating, exquisite mind. So let me call you a miracle.
I don't know. That sounds entirely too holy. I found the buckle of his belt. Nathaniel twisted his hips away and spun me so my back was against the wall. Running his hands down my sides, my husband sank to his knees in front of me.
Then let me worship you.
His hands ran up the inside of my legs, under my skirt until I gasped. Confirmed. Worship is go. A month after we heard about Parker's surgery, I walked into the Monday morning meeting and he was sitting there. A stiff neck brace held his head rigidly in place. He was thinner, and he'd been trimmed to begin with. He had shadows under his eyes, and I hadn't seen that even during the worst of the leg problems. But if you just looked at his demeanor, none of his troubles were apparent. Laughing, he leaned back in his chair, using the angle of it to look up at the folks surrounding him.
So I said that if they were trying to save weight, they'd have to get the astronauts to leave their purses at home.
The guys laughed. Nicole lifted her cup of coffee and said,
But if we did that, where would you keep your balls?
I loved her so much.
All right, people, let's get to work.
Clemens strode into the room, trailing smoke like a badly tuned engine.
Parker, good to have you back.
I grabbed a cup of coffee and settled into my seat next to Nicole. Leaning over, I whispered, You are my hero.
You'd think it was a war wound, the way everyone is carrying on over him.
She opened her binder, pretending to pay attention to Clemens.
I hear the reason he had to have surgery was to reduce the size of the rod up his ass.
Then it failed.
So true.
The meeting fell into its familiar rhythms as we worked through the plans for the week. Each of us had an area to report. While Parker had been away, I'd begun to feel like the women were integrated into the department more. I'm sure that would change now that he was back.
Pars vivoros and Cleary. You'll be happy to know that the simulator has been repaired so you can resume your mission prep.
Clemens peered at his agenda.
Maloof, we did a good job with the issue with the hatch seal, but it revealed some problem areas with the mission, and I want to do some reassignments. I'm reassigning you from the CM on this lunar mission to commanding the second one.
I winced for him. That had to be tough, but with Parker back, I guess they were assuming he'd be fit enough for launch. Parker's brows went up and he sat forward, head held at a rigid ankle.
Sir, I'm not going to be ready for flight for another year.
I know.
Clemens waved his cigar at him.
York's the new CM.
Air roared past my ears as if I were suddenly feeling all 1,040 miles per hour of the Earth's rotation. I shook my head, trying to clear it. The CM. The command module. That wasn't just being a computer. That was also piloting the craft that would orbit the moon while the lander went to the surface. Someone said my name. More than one person. Pressure and sound came back into focus as Nicole squeezed me into a hug. Maloof came up from behind and wrapped his long arms around me. He said something kind. I don't know what. Across the table, Parker smoldered. He put his hand flat on the table.
May I ask a question?
No, no. I hadn't said anything. I gripped my hands into fists until the nails bit into my palms, then forced myself to breathe. My stomach had knotted into a ball so tight it hurt. 3.1415.
Go ahead. Why York? It has been made abundantly clear to me that the moon mission isn't going to succeed without a computer on board. The Siam will be out of contact with the Earth every time it flies into the moon's dark side.
Clemens slid a sheet of paper toward me.
This is a list of the computers that work for the IAC. I want you to go through it and identify anyone that can be trained as a pilot.
I didn't need the list to know whose name belonged at the top. Helen Liu, already a pilot and has jet experience. But I took the list. I'll work on the rest.
I'd like to help York with that.
Parker gave an earnest smile. He wanted to help? Help me? What kind of pain medicine are you on?
You'd like some, wouldn't you?
His smile was casual, all joking between colleagues. But I could see the threat that lay underneath it. Toe the line, he'd said. And he had to see me getting the first lunar landing instead of him as jumping the line.
It's important to think about the temperament of the candidate as well. York's got the expertise to talk about the computing side, and I trust her as a pilot, but space is a different thing, and she hasn't been up there. Besides, I'd like to feel like I'm of some use.
He sounded so reasonable. He'd even slipped a compliment in there. But I'd seen him use that earnest smile as a weapon before. The paper with the computer's names rattled in my grip. Clemens nodded.
Good, good. I'm going to use you as Capcom on a couple of missions, but this shouldn't interfere.
Actually, maybe we should take advantage of having some of the other ladies here to talk through what attributes we're looking for in a candidate, since the computers are all women.
He held up his hand.
But I don't want to mess with your agenda on my first day back. I'm just so eager to get back to work.
I swallowed my fear and tried to take control of the conversation. That's a great idea, Parker. Why don't you and I come up with an initial list, and then we can vet it with the group later? That'll give the director time to get it on the agenda.
Absolutely.
There was his shit-eating grin.
And there are some easy points we can establish right up front. For instance, the candidates need to be emotionally stable, so it would be an obvious black mark if any of them were, say, taking Milltown.
1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11. Nicole gave her debutante laugh.
Don't be foolish. That would disqualify half of the United States.
Oh, no. Nicole, don't. Don't sacrifice your own chance in space. 13, 17, 23. I somehow managed to match her laugh. Right. I mean, for heaven's sake, I take it. Parker's brows went up so fast that you might almost have thought I'd surprised him.
Is that what's been affecting your reaction times in testing?
Maloof snorted.
If this is York when she's thinking slowly, then I'd be terrified of her at full speed.
Next to him, Cleary nodded.
She had the trajectory calculated in her head in less than 10 minutes, then ran it again on paper for safety.
He held up his hands and shook his head.
I've never seen anything like it.
Parker couldn't join the nodding because of his neck brace, but he leaned forward in his chair.
And thank God for that.
There was that earnest shrug of his.
I just worry what she'll do in space if she's in a high-pressure situation and can't get the Milltown.
I kept trying to find words to stop him, but my tongue latched itself down as if it wanted to prove him right. And then Minkowski cleared his throat. He steepled his fingers and gave Parker a solemn stare.
Look, we all know that you don't like her, and we all know why. And we also know what would have happened to Maloof and me if she hadn't been on duty that night.
He jabbed a finger at Parker, and I ground my teeth into the inside of my cheek to keep from bursting into tears.
You're telling me that saving our lives wasn't a high-pressure situation?
All I'm saying is that the floor of mission control is completely different from space.
Tarazis spoke up from his place near the rear of the room.
Just as a point of data, the flight surgeon offered me Miltown when we came back to Earth. I turned him down because I was worried it would get me grounded. So, I would like to volunteer my services to review the right temperament to be an astronaut. But I'll tell you this. York has it.
Parker drew breath, and Clemens held up his hand, cutting him off.
You aren't there, Parker. I've got no questions about York's fitness, and that's not the topic of discussion. All we're concerned with is which computers to add to the list. Of course.
Parker gave a little shrug and glanced at Betty for just a bare moment.
I'd be happy to work with York on that.
Drawing a line through something on the agenda, Clemens said,
Tarazus, you help York with sorting the list. You'll be working together on moon prep anyway.
By all that was holy, I was going to the moon. Parker had tried to ground me and failed. I was going to the goddamned moon. Oh, Nathaniel and I were going to have such a good rocket launch. 38.
Engineer's plan for a trip to Mars, January 8th, 1958. In a book entitled Das Mars Project, published in Germany, Dr. Werner von Braun has developed a plan for a journey to Mars, which he has presented frequently in lectures and in popular magazines of large circulation here. He is convinced that it is technically possible to organize and send out an expedition of 70 to Mars.
As soon as the Monday morning meeting let out, Nicole grabbed my arm and pulled me into the ladies' room. A moment later, Jasira and Sabia followed us in. Sabia leaned against the door as if any of the male astronauts would be caught dead in the ladies' room. Or maybe it wasn't to keep the men out. Betty and Violette weren't here. Nicole leaned me against the sink as if I were a delicate flower that needed to be propped up. She glanced at Sabia and Jasira.
Did you see the way Parker was looking at Betty?
My heart, which had begun to slow down, ramped back up again. I did. Jasira nodded as well.
I think she's going to run the Milltown story straight to life.
Thank God Nicole had given me the sink to lean against, because my knees might have buckled right then. In her drive to advance her career, Betty had already tossed me to the reporters once. That was not nearly as juicy a story as this. If the fact that one of the lady astronauts needed to take a tranquilizer hit the paper, that would make things more difficult for all of us. So I needed to tell Clemens that I couldn't go and get him to pick someone else. Helen. Helen had the same math skills I did, and... A tiny rational part of my brain screamed from way down deep inside, "You are panicking." I gripped the edge of the sink until the formica bit into the flesh of my fingers. 1, 2, 3, 5, 7. Nicole's, Sabia's, and Jasira's voices came at me through a vat of tar. 11, 13, 17, 19. There had to be something we could do. This wasn't something I could face on my own. It would affect Nicole as well if anyone started really digging into our medical records. I turned my head to them and clawed my throat open. Betty.
What?
Nicole broke off in mid-sentence and turned to face me.
I need to talk to Betty.
Parker won't go to the press on his own because if it ever got out that he'd leaked the news, that would tarnish his reputation. If I knew nothing else about Stetson Parker at this point, it was that he valued the idea of his own legacy. He also, I think, genuinely cared about the space program. I didn't like the way that manifested, but it was real. If I can convince Betty not to run it. Sabia shoved off from her place by the door.
Be right back. You'll want backup.
Jasira followed her out of the bathroom, ponytail swinging in an arc with her turn. By my side, Nicole pulled some paper towels from the wall dispenser and wet them.
You okay?
My head dropped forward so that my chin rested on my chest. Yes?
Wash your face.
She handed me the wad of damp towels.
You'll feel better.
You sound like my mother. But I took the towels because Mama had always been right about that. The cool paper blotted some of the heat from my cheeks and forehead. How did we get here?
By being good.
No. I mean, I used to be friends with Betty, and now... I shrugged. I shouldn't have gotten so mad with her about the Girl Scout thing. Nicole snorted, please. She made that bed. I helped.
Maybe, but...
The door to the bathroom opened. Jasira pulled Betty in, with Sabia close on her heels. She let Betty go and positioned herself with Sabia by the door, arms crossed over her chest. Betty glanced over her shoulder and then back at me.
Well, I feel like I'm back in high school again.
Her lips curled in a sardonic smile.
Going to accuse me of being a slut?
I still had the damp towel in my hand and set it down on the counter. I was going to apologize.
Was?
Am. I'm sorry for being so angry about the Girl Scout thing. I've treated you badly. I took a breath and wiped my hands on my trousers. And I wanted to ask for a favor.
It's not really an apology if it comes with a price tag.
True. Fair.
But then I wouldn't expect a Jew to give something away for free.
Through the white heat of my rage, I saw Nicole push off from the sink.
I find that offensive. Oh, are you a Jewess now? I don't have to be to recognize offensive language.
She crossed the room and glared at Betty.
You were a wasp. Have you forgotten why we fought the war?
It's okay. It wasn't, but I needed to pretend it was, so I stepped away from the sink. Our intervention wasn't helping and might even make things worse. Betty, I'm sorry. May I? I just wanted to talk to you. May we? She pursed her lips for a moment, then gave a cursory nod.
Go ahead.
Could you not tell life that I take Milltown? Tension locked my ribs into a knot.
Please?
She shook her head slowly.
Look, I'm sorry. This is my career.
Ours too? I gestured to the five of us crowded into the bathroom. Women in the space program are already on shaky ground. How do you think it will look if one of them is on tranquilizers?
If you don't get into space, you can go back to the computer department. You have a husband who's in the program. It is a colony effort, so it will just be a matter of time before they let you go up, even if I run the article tomorrow. Me? They're never going to let me go. I don't have another career. All I've got is this job with Life magazine.
Betty rested her hands on her hips and stared at the floor.
I'm sorry. I really am.
Jasira cocked her head.
Do even you want to go into space? Yes.
Betty's voice cracked, and she balled her hands into fists.
Jesus! Why does everyone think that I don't care? Parker keeps saying I'm not a pilot, but I am, and... Forget it.
I'll teach you math. The offer came out before my brain caught up with me.
What?
I used to tutor at university. Not just arithmetic, but the higher level stuff. This was like Parker offering to certify me on the T-38 if I didn't tell anyone about the weakness in his left leg. Had he felt this gripping desperation wrapping itself around his middle when he'd been talking to me? I sighed, letting my ego out so I could keep going. They want more computers. I can teach you to be one.
And if I say no?
Behind me, Nicole shifted inside.
Then we go back to high school. I know about Parker, and I know about his wife.
Betty's face went pale. I'd thought that she might be sleeping with Parker, but whatever was going on with his wife was outside my awareness. And it didn't matter. I wasn't Parker. No. I turned to face Nicole. We're not going to play that game. If Betty doesn't want to help us, then that's her call. We'll respect that, and I'll figure out something else. Nicole's jaw set, as if she were about to argue with me. In the mirror over the sink, I could see Betty, brows drawn together, leaning back on her heels as if she would flee if she could. Behind her, Jasira and Sabia guarded the door. All of them watched me. And in the mirror, I could see who I could become. I could become Parker, pushing with everything I had to get into space. I let my breath out, counting through a Fibonacci sequence. I'm sorry, Betty. I'm sorry I've treated you badly, and I'm sorry I tried to bully you into changing your story. Turning, I rubbed my forehead. The offer to tutor you in math still stands. She blinked at me, and then, surprising everyone, including herself, I think, Betty burst into tears. For a moment, we all stood there, shocked. I don't know who moved first. Maybe Nicole, maybe Jasira, maybe me. But in a moment, we all had her surrounded and held. And that was when I knew that we really had something. We were lady astronauts, all of us. And goddammit, we were all going to go into space. I was not the first woman in space, nor would I be the first woman on the moon. My role was to fly the command module while my male colleagues went to the surface. The night before we all went into isolation, it wouldn't do to get ill during the 8 days we were in space, Nathaniel and I threw a party. Nicole let us borrow her house since our apartment was too tiny. It is a strange thing, knowing that in a little over a week, you will be strapped to a 4-megaton bomb and hurled into airless space. Every time I spoke to someone, I couldn't help but think, this might be the last time. But I'd been given a second chance with Aunt Esther, hadn't I? She sat next to me on the sofa in Nicole's living room with a rum and coke perched on her knee. The party might have been in my honor, but she was the life of it. The worst of it was that I'd lost Mama's union card under the roller coaster. There I was, on the horns of a dilemma. Eugene Lindholm knelt on one knee to listen to Aunt Esther, while Myrtle perched on the arm of the sofa. He seemed to find my aunt endlessly charming.
What did you do, ma'am?
I'd been a little concerned when I introduced her to the Lindholms. What would this old Southern woman think about our black friends? I needn't have worried. She laid her hand on Eugene's arm.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I knew that if I didn't find the card, Mama would know that I'd snuck out to the carnival. And worse, she wouldn't be able to work. So Rose and I snuck behind the roller coaster, then I hitched my skirt up to my thighs and crawled under it. If Mama had known how much leg I was exposing, she would have been more upset by that than the loss of her card. But I got it back. Yes, I did.
Herschel sat in the chair to my right, his crutches propped against its side. He leaned over to me and gestured to Aunt Esther.
It's like this at home. If we can get her telling stories from when she was a kid, there's no end to them. What she had for breakfast, not so much.
But it's working out? He smiled.
It's perfect. Well, all right, not perfect, but the kids love her. And she's able to help Doris with cooking, so it's pretty good. Speaking of kids, Tommy!
Now, I've been talking so much, I haven't had a drop to drink. Why don't you tell me about yourself, young man?
Aunt Esther took a sip of her rum and coke, bright eyes shining at Eugene. I had to admire how skillfully Aunt Esther dodged the fact that she couldn't remember Eugene's name. I made a note to try that line next time I was in the barrel on a press junket. Tommy arrived at his father's side.
Yes, sir?
Go get the present we brought Aunt Elma.
He nodded and ran off again, all long legs. I shook my head. I swear he's a foot taller than last year.
We can't keep him in clothes. Heading in for astronaut testing.
I swiveled to Eugene.
What? When were you going to tell me? Congratulations!
They just sent the letters out.
Eugene shrugged, looking surprisingly sheepish.
You've been a little busy.
Which is understandable.
Myrtle rested a hand on his shoulder with proprietary pride.
He passed the tests before, so hopefully, this time they'll have the sense the good Lord gave them and accept him.
Well, Parker likes you, which will help enormously. I left alone our continuing animosity. At times it seemed as if it had vanished, but he never let me forget about the Milltown.
You said the letters just went out?
Excuse me. I stood and went in search of Helen. She, Ida, and Imogene stood near the punch bowl, giggling with Betty.
Still can't believe. Shush.
Shush?
I stopped next to them and arched a brow. So you've either just spiked the punch, or
or you got a letter that none of you told me about?
Helen bounced on her toes, face splitting into a grin that looked like it must hurt.
I get to take the tests.
Us too.
Ida clinked her glass against Imogene's and Helen's. All three of the women looked as giddy as kids starting summer vacation. Betty grinned at me.
I'm going to walk them through the physical tests.
And I'll keep up the math coaching while you're in space.
Helen punched me in the shoulder.
I never get tired of saying that.
Nathaniel came up behind me and draped an arm over my shoulder.
I can tell these are your friends because they're excited about taking tests.
He kissed my cheek and raised his glass.
Congratulations, ladies. Here's to the stars.
Laughing, I clinked my glass against my friends.
Better yet, here's to the Lady Astronaut Club.
39.
Two astronauts and an astronaut prepare for the moon. Kansas City, Kansas, July 20th, 1958. The two men who will be the first to tread the moon early on Monday may find that walking is not the best way to get around. The answer may be a kangaroo hop. While they are exploring the surface, Lady Astronaut Dr. Elma York will be keeping the home fires burning in the capsule orbiting the moon, waiting for their return.
Today, I am going into space. Everything about today is vivid in ways that nothing else in life can equal. My wedding to Nathaniel has been reduced by time to a series of snapshots and captured moments packed in a haze of joy. But today, the light gleaming atop the egg yolk in my breakfast contains the most vibrant yellow orange. This is the last meal I will eat before going into space. Les Bourgeois and Terrazas are sitting across from me, and we are talking through the last details before the flight. There is a photographer in the room, screened for health by the IAC, but he does not matter. We are going into space today. This is Terrazas' fifth flight and Les Bourgeois' seventh. I am the only rookie here. I am the only woman. A tall, broad-shouldered man with gray hair and jowls comes into the room, and for a moment I don't recognize him as Clemens. He does not have his cigar. The smell of it still lingers, though, in a heavy musk.
All packed.
I nod, pushing my chair back from the table. My post-flight things are in my room. There's a note.
I'll hold on to it.
Clemens nods and shoves his hands into his pockets, as if he can't figure out what to do with them without the cigar. We walk down the hall. It might be the last time I walk down this hall. To the dressing rooms. The photographer follows us, but splits off to go with the men. I am grateful for the first time that I am the only woman on the flight. That changes when I enter the dressing room, because the other two astronauts have each other for company while they are getting suited. I know the team here, of course. Part of my training included dry runs of this moment, but I find that I have no words in me but the single phrase, I am going to space today. In relative silence, I strip and pull on the long underwear that will be next to my skin for most of the flight. I will wear this into space today. They've dressed other astronauts, so they don't force me to talk. Thank God for professionals. It takes all three of us to wrestle me into the pressure suit. It is designed to be snug and protect me from the elements, or the lack thereof, in space. Where I am going today. Settling into the chair, I stare straight ahead at the concrete wall as they lower the helmet over my head. These are the last breaths of the Earth's atmosphere that I will take for the next 8 days. Someone is wearing White Shoulders bath powder. I recognize the fragrance because Grandma used it. The helmet clicks into place, changing the sound of the room. It does not muffle the way a jet flight helmet does. It reflects the sounds of my own body back, and the metallic stink of canned oxygen hisses around me. I inhale, slowly and carefully. Then I lift both stiff arms of the suit to give them a thumbs up. All good. They nod and give me the okay sign. The outside world sits at a distance. I won't be able to hear it until I am patched into the ship's system. Now I have to wait for the nitrogen to work its way out of my bloodstream, If I didn't, I could wind up with the bins when we went into space. The Earth's atmosphere is 14.7 psi, but the capsule is only pressurized to 5.5 psi. There's a cluster of imperfections on the cinder block wall that looks like a dragon's head. I wonder what the psychologists at our initial tests would have made of that. Awkward in the suit, I turn and wave to catch one of the dresser's attention. When she looks at me, I mime opening a book. She smiles and reaches into the cabinet for the reading material that I selected for this wait. It is the gift my brother gave me at my going to space party. Superman number 11, the prize of his comic book collection. Weeping would be an unfortunate choice. I am an astronaut. I am inside a spacesuit, and I am going into space today. The elevator down from the astronaut's isolation suite is only 3 stories, but it is slow. The portable oxygen unit I'm carrying is heavy, but when someone offered to carry it for me, I declined. If the men can do this, so can I. Still, I am beginning to regret the choice by the time the elevator finally reaches the bottom. 2 elevator repairmen ride down with us, just in case. It would be an inauspicious start if we all got stuck in an elevator on the way to the moon. Le Bourgeois is shifting from foot to foot. I have never seen him nervous before. The doors open and a crowd of reporters is waiting for us. They told us to expect that, so when we get outside, the 3 of us pause for a minute to let them take pictures. I take a deep breath of the canned oxygen and smile. My heart has been trotting along faster than usual, but my spacesuit protects me from their questions. What will people think seeing these photos of 3 astronauts in their tinfoil suits? Inside the building, my brother, his family, and Aunt Esther are waiting for the launch. They will be in the observation room looking over mission control right now. Nathaniel will be on the floor, standing at his desk instead of sitting like a normal human being. We walk away from the reporters and get into the van that will drive us to the rocket. It stands like a vast monolith, a testament to the persistence of mankind. That. I am going to ride that. There is, of course, the possibility that we won't go today. Launches get scrubbed all the time. A faulty wire, the weather, a man with a bomb. We might have to go through all of this again tomorrow. I'd been in mission control often enough when we had to scrub. When we get out of the van, there are technicians waiting for us by the bottom of the elevator leading up the gantry. Terrazas stops me with a hand on my arm and points up. I lean back, the only way to look up in the suit. The sound of my gasp echoes against the sides of my helmet. The Artemis 9 steams in the morning sun like a living beast. Intellectually, I know it's because of the super-chilled oxygen, but my God, she is beautiful. When I look back down, Terrazas is still looking up, and so is Le Bourgeois. Both men are grinning when we finally finish gawking like tourists and walk into the elevator. It rattles and shakes as we ride up, and the vast prairies of Kansas spread out at our feet. Without being told, I stop on the gantry before I climb into the capsule. We all do. Inside, the windows face straight up. This will be my last view of Earth until I am in space. The high, clear silver of the sky lays over the Earth like a blanket. In the distance, a pair of T-38s circle the perimeter of the IAC to keep our flight path clear. We'd once had to delay a launch because some tourist decided to fly in to watch the launch from the air. The grasslands have just begun to turn green after a 2-short winter with barely any snow. A patch of pink shifts in the breeze as early wildflowers greet the dawn. I inhale, as if I could breathe in the fragrance of the earth one last time, but all I get is more canned oxygen. I turn to face our craft, 1 glove against its side. Terrazas gets to his knees and crawls inside. I give the crew time to get him settled, and then it is my turn. I'll be in the center bench for the ride up. Le Bourgeois will have the left, as is traditional for the commander of a mission. The seat cradles me with my legs up in the air. The crew tightens down the straps that will hold me firmly in place as we launch, and switches my oxygen over to the ship's source. It is still metallic, but less tinny than the little portable pack. That might be my imagination, though. Les Bourgeois is settled, and then sound comes back into my world as our comms are patched in. Les Bourgeois says,
Kansas, Atmos 9, we are in position.
Parker's voice crackles into my ear from his seat at Capcom.
Position confirmed. Welcome aboard.
The hatch closes, taking away the last view of Earth. All I can see now is the silver sky above us. All of us have checklists to run through, and I do, making sure that all the gauges and switches that I am responsible for are in the correct position. For the trip up, I will have very little to do. I am a passenger while Les Bourgeois is the pilot. Even that is mostly a name because he will only need to take the controls before we are in space if something goes wrong. And even then, the list of survivable errors is short. When we get into orbit, we have only 2 hours to prep for the transition to the translunar insertion. In theory. Everything we can do now to prepare for the TLI will buy us time, which is why we practiced this until we can do the checklist by rote. There is something about having your legs over your head that makes you need to pee. This makes it into none of the press releases, but every single astronaut talks about it. The men have complicated condoms and catch pouches. I have a diaper. 2 hours into our 3-hour wait, I use it, sure that the urine will overflow its confines and spread up the back of my suit. It does not, but I am once again enthralled by the glamour of being an astronaut. And then, somehow, we are in the last 6 minutes before launch. I have gone through my checklist 4 or 5 times, certain that I've missed something. Outside our tiny capsule, my family is being led to the roof of the IAC to watch the launch. Before I was assigned to a mission, I thought that this was a kindness to give them a spectacular view. I thought that right up until I was asked to pick an escort for my family from among the astronauts. Binkowski's wife once made a joke about her escort to widowhood. Our families were on the roof, isolated from the press, so if something went wrong, so if we died during launch, the IAC would have control over them. The media would get no pictures of the moment grief set in. We projected the appearance of triumph. Parker's voice crackles in my ear.
York, the engineering desk says to remind you of prime numbers.
The engineering desk. I can't say your husband, or just give Nathaniel a moment with the comm. On the other hand, Nathaniel should be able to hear me at this point. Please thank engineering, and say that I'll continue work on my theorem regarding divisibility when we return, pending a successful rocket launch.
Message confirmed.
And without a pause, he returns to the technical jargon.
Engine test is go.
The ship shudders and lurches against its bolts. Beneath us, the two massive Sirius engines swivel to test their range of motion. We'd been told to expect this, but they couldn't get the simulator to mimic the moment when the engines first got power.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting. We have passed T-minus 60, 55 seconds and counting.
Les Bourgeois says,
Thank you, Mission Control, for the smooth countdown. Confirmed, thanks. We've passed the 50-second mark. Power transfer is complete.
The last of our gauges leaps to life, needles spiking like my heart. Les Bourgeois nods, watching the gauges.
Confirmed internal power. 30 seconds away from the Artemis 9 liftoff. All the first stage tanks now pressurized. Confirmed pressurization.
Les Bourgeois is the French priest in our tiny chapel, reciting the litany of space.
35 seconds and counting. We are still go with Artemis 9. 30 seconds and counting. Everything is very good here. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. Confirmed internal guidance.
Les Bourgeois lifts his hand to rest it over the clock, waiting. I clench the arms of my couch, counting with them in my head.
12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts.
The engine roars to life beneath us, and the entire rocket shakes like a cabin in an earthquake. It's always been quiet at mission control during this moment, but now, sitting atop the rocket, there is no delay between ignition and the sound.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Liftoff.
The rocket thunders beneath us and pushes me deep into my couch. The acceleration pulls me back as if the Earth is trying to keep us from leaving. Le Bourgeois pushes the clock start.
Roger, clock. Tower cleared. Roger, we have the program.
Clouds spin past the windows as we roll into the right attitude for our orbit.
Confirmed roll program.
We rip clear of the clouds into startling blue. Abruptly, the ride smooths out as we push through the sound barrier and the thunder of the rocket falls away behind us faster than we are traveling. We're on our own now. There's nothing that Mission Control can do until we are in orbit.
Artemis 9, this is Kansas. You are go for staging.
Now Le Bourgeois' voice sounds strained by the G-forces pressing us into our seats.
Inboard cutoff?
We confirm inboard cutoff.
The blue of the sky grows deeper into a rich velvet, then darkens to black. It is so dark that it is not a color but an absence. Ink, velvet, dark. None of these give the sense of the depth of space.
Staging?
His hands move over the controls, flipping switches. The G-load vanishes, and I fly up against my restraints. Past our windows, the dark sky flares red and gold. Pieces of housing whip past, trailing sparks.
And ignition?
And then silence. Beneath us, the smaller engine pushes us higher, out of the Earth's influence. But without an atmosphere, it is largely silent, letting us know its presence only through the vibrations of the ship. We are technically in space. But if Le Bourgeois and Mission Control don't get us into the right orbit, we'll fall back to Earth. A loose end of my harness floats up in front of me. Up. I turn my attention from that and watch the gauges, doing the first task of the navigation that will be my job for the next 8 days. Secco, we are showing 101.4 by 103.6. Parker replies with the same calm he has for everyone. He's probably tossing his tennis ball in the air.
Roger, shutdown. We copy 101.4 by 103.6.
The capsule is silent, save for the sound of my breath and the hiss of the oxygen fans. 101 miles below us, the tracking stations are following our flight path and sending numbers through the teletype to a table in Kansas City. Two computers are there, Masira and Helen, who will convert those numbers into elegant equations.
Artemis 9, this is Kansas. You are confirmed go for orbit.
Le Bourgeois turns his head and grins at me through his helmet.
Congratulations, you are officially an astronaut.
My face hurts. I'm smiling so hard that my cheeks are tight balls of joy. We have work to do, right?
No shortage of it. But wait.
Terrazas puts a hand on my arm and then gestures to the windows.
Look.
There is nothing to see but that vast blackness. Intellectually, I know that we've passed into the dark side of the Earth. We slide into her shadow, and then magic fills the sky. The stars come out, millions of them in crisp, vivid splendor. These are not the stars that I remember from before the meteor. These are clear and steady, without an atmosphere to make them twinkle. Do you remember the first time you saw the stars again? I am sitting in a capsule on my way to the moon.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Calculating Stars, a Lady Astronaut novel. Written and performed by Mary Robinette Kowal. Executive producers Steve Feltberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2018 by Mary Robinette Kowal. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.